everyone, and welcome back to Senate Finance. This is a continuation of the meeting last night. We're going to continue with the gentleman from the...
Don't have a single microphone on me. All right. Welcome back to Senate Finance. It is a continuation of last night's meeting, and we're going to hear a continuation of the presentation from the gentleman from the investor group. Poor name. What do you call yourselves? The
HOA.
From the HOA, yeah. Signatories to the HOA. And as you recall, we heard kind of a high-level presentation from them last night, and there were some additional questions that I think the committee wanted to get to, and so we can do that today. After we speak with you, we will gavel out and adjourn, and then come back into session on today's session, and we'll hear from Commissioner Pulaski and Deputy Commissioner Pulaski and Commissioner Bailey. So I think the last thing I remember is Senator Dunleavy said, I have a bunch of questions. So Senator Dunleavy, you have the floor.
Mr. Chair, that is still true today.
Okay.
So thank you. Are we ready? To the chair, who's going to build a pipeline?
Can I get on the list?
What do you want?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair.
You have a question?
A pipeline project or any mega project is, as far as who is going to build it, I guess is a broad, maybe even a complex question. At the grassroots level, it's going to be built by a whole host of contractors and experts that build projects. Those are going to be managed by this group who have conducted mega projects throughout the planet. LNG projects, pipeline projects, certainly TransCanada is a preeminent North American pipeline builder who directs such projects to be built. So it's the group directing the actual individuals, the 10,000 contractors and whatnot that will be active in the construction phase of the project as it's conducted.
Is there an entity that's going to take the lead in that?
Could you repeat the question, Senator?
Is there an entity that will take the lead in that? I understand the whole subcontractor concept on any project, but is there an entity that's going to take the lead?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, today the lead party for this group is ExxonMobil.
For the construction of the pipeline?
Well, Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, we haven't yet concluded the necessary agreements that will be governing the construction of the project. That will be determined. Today, that entity is ExxonMobil. I don't know.
Okay. I still have...
Just keep going.
Okay. This is a broad question for everybody, and I'd just like to get all of your opinions. What do you like about this arrangement? And then I'm going to ask you what you don't like about the arrangement.
So Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil, Senator Dunleavy through the chair. What ExxonMobil really likes about this arrangement is the breadth of participation we have at this point. We have the three producers who hold a interest in a large percentage of the gas on the North Slope. We have TransCanada, who has their pipeline experience and Alaska experience. We also have the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation with their expertise on getting gas to Alaska. And so, that's what ExxonMobil likes best about the project.
What don't you like about the project, or the arrangement, I should say?
What we've done, Senator Dunleavy through the chair, is we've come together and we've solved the problems that were in front of us to get the heads of agreement in place, and I think that was a real constructive process. And so I think that any other challenges that face us, it's going to be that same kind of problem solving that's going to be able to get us through that. So at this point, I don't see downsides with the way that we're organized. I only see opportunities.
Senator Dunleavy through the chair, Dave Vantile from BP. What I like about the arrangement, there's a lot I like about the arrangement. The fact that we have all of these entities in front of you aligned on a way forward is is tremendously important. Starting out on a project like this on a common footing where we've agreed the forward framework and we've proven that we can work together to solve problems, as my colleague Mr. McMahon mentioned, demonstrated by the execution of the HOA. It was not an easy document to negotiate and hammer through. We all had certain concerns at one time or another, but one of the things that encourages me greatly is that all the parties here actually generously listened to those concerns and found a way to work forward and get something that we could all agree. That's a tremendous asset, the ability to work through those problems. And that will continue. Well, there will be other issues that come up. With a demonstrated ability to listen and solve those problems is important. The entities before you represent something like 98% of the known gas on the North Slope. That's an ascent, that's an important element to have on any sponsor of a project. We have entities that have built LNG mega projects around the world successfully. We have a preeminent North American pipeline builder with whom our companies have done business in the past and who knows the Alaska project well. And I think very important to the essential to the success of the project, we have Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, whose focus imparted by this body is to get gas to Alaskans. A successful project will have to get gas to Alaskans, and we have AGDC directly in the HOA, and we've talked about the importance of cooperation with AGDC. All those things are elements that I like about our arrangement. I think maybe the one thing I don't like is just looking forward at a price tag of a project that's potentially as high as $65 billion in the October letter that the project sent to the governor. That's daunting. And of course, our objective is to, through pre-feed, on through feed, is to define that cost better. Hopefully, that estimate will come down. There's no guarantee that it will. But we certainly want the project to be able to be delivered at a competitive cost of supply in the world market. So that's going to be one of our primary focuses on that cost of the project.
You anticipate this will be the most expensive LNG project done ever?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, we hope not. It's certainly in that conversation right now. There's others that are of similar magnitude. You know, the Gorgon project in Australia is about the same sort of price tag. Our objective, obviously, is to be able to deliver it at the lowest cost possible. But it's huge.
Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. My name is Pat Flood with ConocoPhillips. So I think the thing that we most like about this, and I'll echo a little bit of what my other co-venturers said, is the alignment that this brings. But I think the thing that hasn't been talked about is how this could create a historic new relationship between the producers and the oil and gas industry in the state of Alaska. I mean, by finding a way to have aligned interests and reduce disputes and reduce a lot of the things that's caused tension in the past, I think this could be a new era. Mr. Van Tile took the words right out of my mouth as far as what I don't like about this project. I don't like that how much it costs. We would love it if this could be done for a lot less money. But we're faced with the realities of what it takes to do this project. And the next steps of this project will be to try to fix that to the extent we can. To try to do this, to do it well, to make it reliable, to make it a project that customers will rely on, but also to do it for as little as possible.
Thank you. Can we skip to TransCanada and then we'll come over to AGDC?
Sure. It's Tony Palmer with TransCanada. I won't add much to what my colleagues have described. I think the alignment issues are the most positive factors in front of us, and the fact that we have the sovereign, being the state that is the owner of the gas, in addition to the leaseholders to my right, that ultimately control the gas. That's required. And in addition to the expertise that they have described, They also have the expertise to market the gas. They're active in the marketplace every day, and this group of companies clearly has the skill set to bring this project through to successful completion. I have nothing further to add on the downside. The scale of the project is something that all parties wish was smaller, but the fact that we're going to try to move 3-plus BCF a day off the North Slope dictates that you need to spend this amount of money for a very large project.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. Dan Fauske, president of Alaska Gas Line Development Corp. I like the project or the arrangement based for the reasons stated, that everyone's at a room discussing, everyone's brought top people to it, great deal of attention being paid, and I've learned in my life that anytime you have people at a table talking with similar goals, that you can get something done, and that's a good position to be in. What I don't like about the arrangement is that it's easy for me to get sidetracked. My stated goal of the HB4 is to get gas to Alaskans and to also cooperate on the development of a big line, which we're doing, but sometimes it's easy to get detoured, and we have to always bring ourselves back in. The group, the heads of arrangement, have been very congenial in that regard, understanding our mission, which doesn't necessarily equate to their mission, and I mean that in a positive way. On a huge project like this with a global, they've been very cognizant of the fact our representation is to help facilitate the project, but also that we have another goal in mind, and that's get gas to our citizens. And that's, so sometimes I don't like that because it's easy to get off in the weeds on something else. But
through the chair, just two brief questions, then a statement, then I'll yield my time if that's okay. Yesterday there was a mention of takeoffs versus straddle plants, and I'd like to get that clarified, because the people of Alaska, obviously we want to drive down the price of gas for people in Alaska, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the straddle plant concept, we had thought at one time, or many of us did, that it would allow takeoff for propane. And we envisioned propane being shipped down the Yukon, going up to some of our rural coastal areas, et cetera. Can you do propane without a straddle plant? And I understand the takeoff would be just your gas and piping it to folks in Fairbanks and in the road communities, which is good. But what do you folks... are there going to be straddle plants, or is it just going to be takeoffs?
And are we misusing the word straddle plant? I think that might be a
possibly
pertinent question.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Dunleavy, straddle plant was a term that we used quite a bit on our line when we originally were at 24-inch, 2,500 PSI, and we were hauling liquids. I think last night's testimony, I believe it was Mr. Van Tile, we did a similar study, and we were looking at natural gas liquids, gas to liquids, and LNG, and we came to the conclusion that the most likely candidate for commercial activity off the line would be LNG, and we wrote that a couple years ago, and I think those words have proven to be true as the large producers are looking at the same. We had filed for our EIS, and we did not want to disrupt that process, so we waited until we had the EIS in our hand, and then we optimized the line last December by going to a 36-inch, 1,400 PSI line that did remove the liquids except for 1.5% propane, which is about 4,000 barrels a day in our structure of propane, to do the very thing you just mentioned, potential down the Yukon, down the Richardson, and to get propane, if possible, to some of our rural areas. This straddle plant that we had envisioned was about a $250 million structure. One would be located at Dunbar, about 35 miles west of Fairbanks, and the other one would be located at our end point. We have taken those out with the idea in mind that there was just, with the huge shale explosion of gas in the lower 48, that those markets became very difficult. We did not rule them out if we get into an open season and there seems to be some type of activity to look at a GTL or something. We would certainly be open to that. So the straddle plant is a term defining a structure that would be taking those liquids out, getting it down to, utility-based gas, methane, to ship over to Fairbanks, get into people's homes or businesses, re-inject the liquids and ship it back down. I think what we envision for these folks, and I'm not an expert on this, but that there wouldn't necessarily be a straddle plant. There might be something that has to be done to the gas, and I can't speak to that, but it's not at the magnitude that we were looking at, because it is a different mixture of gas, and maybe they could explain better than I. But.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. Yeah, appreciate the question that we had last night. Had a chance to think about that, and so to clarify, what we're proposing with the Alaska LNG project is to take gas as it exists today at Prudhoe Bay and potentially from Point Thompson, bring that gas to a central location on the North Slope, take out the carbon dioxide, take out other impurities, bring that gas down through the state down to an LNG plant, have a minimum of 5 offtake points, and basically those offtake points are a T in the line with a valve, and then what happens downstream of that valve would have to be customized to the customers who would be taking gas. And so the first thought is that the pressure would have to be reduced to the pressure that those customers would need for their purposes. In that pressure reduction, some hydrocarbon liquids would necessarily drop out. Those would either be trucked away or pumped back into the big pipeline. And then depending on the customer, there might be have to be some slight adjustment to the heating content of the natural gas, the BTU per cubic foot. But that would be a fairly straightforward process as well. So you know, that's what we have envisioned as far as delivering gas to Alaskan customers with the Alaska LNG project. Our project is focused on the pipeline and the LNG plant, and you know, that may be a place where AGDC could step in and do the engineering and do the work around what those what that step down facility would look like and how much it would cost. But you know, we're not proposing a straddle plant. We're proposing simple delivery points within the state to meet Alaska energy needs.
Basically, you know, the folks that concur with that. Anything different?
Senator Dunleavy, Pat Flood, Governor Phillips. Yes, I agree with what Bill and Dan both said.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, Dave Van Tile with BP, yes.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, agreeing on the delivery points, where are those delivery points? Because the problem, you know, like 30 years ago, we had water and sewer problems in rural Alaska. So what happened was, there were water wells drilled. That was the delivery point. Everybody had from that community had to come to that point and pack their water to their home. It was better than what was before, but people that were too far away never got to utilize that. So my concern, I guess, is if we, at the end of this project, if we just have the delivery points that are basically unusable to the vast majority of Alaskans, we've defeated our purpose. Alaska is an energy resource state, one of the richest in the state, in the nation, and in fact in the world. But we are, the citizens of Alaska have the highest energy costs. So where are those points? And from my viewpoint, I agree with Senator Dunleavy that in this legislation, Alaskans need to know that we are going to benefit from this gas line directly and not have to go from Quinnahock with a propane bottle to Fairbanks to fill it up and then figure out how to get it to Quinnahock.
You might get a 5 cent deposit on that, Senator.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I just want the record to show that I channeled myself through the senator, and that was my exact question I was going to ask.
It's uncanny how alike you two are.
Because we have two goals here, I think, at the table, which is different than what you have. And I understand that. I mean, we want a large amount of gas being sold so it drives down the price. But we also have a just as important issue for in-state residents. How do we lower their energy costs? And there were discussions about propane. And we're going to have to get into this in more detail because, in the end, what's going to happen is this isn't really a rural versus urban issue as much as it is as a location near cheap energy issue. Because, for example, in the Mattsuk Valley, I have no gas. We heat with wood and we heat with oil. So the question is going to be, how do we drive down the cost of energy for us? Do we do it through the propane concept, or do we end up doing a PCE type of concept where there's another dividend delivered to the folks of Alaska? And there's inherent issues with both of these processes, but we're going to have to be able to answer to our people, what did this pipeline do for us as residents? Because the concern, I'll just wrap up with this, because the concern is we could have a large pipeline that delivers delivers a large volume of gas and that brings in revenue to the state of Alaska, which is a good thing, no doubt about it. But if we don't provide for cheap energy for our people, they're going to migrate. Some of his folks will migrate to where it's cheaper in-state or out-of-state, and some of our folks will migrate out-of-state. And I'm not sure if that's an end result we're looking for. I got one last question. And it may not be able to be answered here, and it may have to come from DOA, but the question I have, again, is in the pre-feed and the feed stage, if the state of Alaska invests the maximum, which in this book appears to be in the neighborhood of $500 million or $450 million, if at that point one of the partners steps out, what happens? Is there a contingency for this project to move forward with three partners, three quadrants? Or does that end the project, and what happens to the $500 million that the state of Alaska invested in this project?
Before you go on to that, the first question you had, Senator Dunleavy, I think that at this stage, this bill doesn't answer that question. It gets us to the point where we can answer that question. And without the work that we'll do in this enabling legislation, we can't answer some of the larger questions about the specifics of the takeoff point. Would you agree with that, Dan?
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that briefly. In the HOA, under Section 5, and I'll read this quickly, but to assist in addressing in-state gas demand, the Alaska LNG project would include at least 5 in-state offtake points, with the specific locations determined by the administration in consultation with AGDC. Any party may deliver gas to an offtake point, and any facilities taking gas from an offtake point, including facilities associated with odorization, reduction of gas pressure, and on. Our job, and we've been meeting with communities all along with this very discussion in mind, even before the large LNG project, was how do we get gas? And speeches I've given, I've always stated that oil fills the treasury, gas gives us security. What's different here is that gas can also start filling security on a large scale. But the primary mission must also be, from my perspective, is to get gas to our citizens. So we're exploring a variety of ways with the Donlin Creek folks, which I know, Senator, gets us closer out to Bethel. I've stated also that until you have a pipe with that energy source in it, you're limited as to the discussion you can have about how do we get it to more people. You know, we have to get that resource to where, you know, if you can get 100 miles from someone, that's a whole lot better than being 800 miles. In reference to how do we develop that, one of the beauties of this state and why many of us live here is because there's not many of us. One of the downsides of this, not many of us, is these projects never pencil in regards to, like they likely would, going into high urban areas or populated areas. But that doesn't mean we don't go solve the problem. That's just a fact of life for us as Alaskans. And so I believe that the ability then exists to get a resource closer, and then entrepreneurs and others can start factoring out ways to get this gas to our residents. I lived in Barrow, and I understand when there's gas in Barrow how much different it was living in Barrow than it was living in Atkinsook or Barter Island or the other places, fine places, but gas, cheap energy changes everything for people. It's so essential. So our job would be to work on that issue in conjunction with a project going forward. There just must be access to that gas, and I hope we are conducting discussion with people. It's difficult. Fairbanks has been very responsive in the sense of a local distribution system. You know, once the gas gets there, how do you, and there are ways to finance those things through LIDS and other mechanisms. Always easier when there's a large population base. But to all of us, the more gas that we can get going down that pipe and out distribution, the benefit is to everyone because your tariffs are lower. And so there's a built-in incentive to get gas to as many people of our people as possible for that very reason.
Thank you. And the last question that I had asked, if you could try and address that, if not, we'll ask the other folks. But we get to the pre-feed feed stage, somebody exits the project. Does the project collapse? Is there a contingency for that? And what happens to the upwards of $500 million that the state's invested to that extent?
If I may, Senator, I'd like to defer to...
Okay.
Senator Dunleavy, to the chair, Dave Vantile with BP. If I could start answering that question with the events that would lead up to a party considering departing the project. I think what certainly the way BP would look at that sort of a situation is, much as we dealt with the issues that came up during the course of negotiating the HOA, a number of folks had specific concerns, issues that maybe we weren't even aware of that needed to be addressed. To the extent we advance the project through pre-feed, through feed, and we find out that for some reason the project's not working for one of the participants, we would endeavor to solve that problem, because you've heard us each say how important alignment is to advancing the project, and that we've actually got the right people here in front of you, these five parties and the state of Alaska, literally all on the same page. That's an absolutely critical ingredient to the successful prosecution of the project and being able to deliver the project at low cost. So our focus would be on solving that problem before we got to the place where someone said, look, I'm out. If we get to that place, it's difficult, because now we do have to see how we can pick up the pieces and continue to advance the project. BP will always want to commercialize our gas resource, so we will look for a way. The winning way, again, we still think, is maintaining the alignment that you see here.
Thank you.
I guess the point is, though, you do lose your investment. I mean, if the project goes kaplooey, or we've got to drop out,
not necessarily if a partner drops out, because you guys have ways of bringing other partners in. People are going to want to invest in this. But if the project stops because of a number of reasons, we essentially lose our investment to that point. That's just part of being in business. I mean, that's what the state is endeavoring to do here, is to be in business.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just briefly to that, that would be an unfortunate incident to occur, but it also then accentuates the benefit of AGDC. We're not going anywhere in the sense of, and I compliment my colleagues here, this is a major business decision that's going to go through. It's almost hard to put your head around a $60 billion project. Our project blended into that makes sense, but if an event something like that were to occur, there are statutes and there's a guiding principle as we need to keep going on our project to ensure that gas can be to Alaska. The ultimate benefit is if this all melts together into a successful project. It's kind of a win-win for everybody, and that's certainly everyone's goal, sir.
And the money spent up to that point buys us information that's valuable for AGDC.
That is correct.
We go to Senator Meyer and then Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I started out only having one question. Now I'm up to three, but I'll try to be brief. I think when we started this conversation, I don't know, a couple weeks ago or something, I asked why I should be excited about this project, because I've been let down in the past, you know, between AGEA and the Port Authority and the APP, I think that's what it was called, TransCanada and Exxon and Denali and ANGDA and et cetera, but this one does appear to be different in the sense that the state's a partner, and that does have me excited. I guess I'll my first question I'd like to address to Exxon. Exxon's a big company. One of the largest in the world, if not the largest. I can't keep track between General Electric and Apple and Walmart, but I know you're up there in the top five or ten anyway. So why, and you're evaluating LNG projects all around the world. Why does this one stand out? What makes this different? What gets you excited about this project as a company?
Okay. Senator Meyer, through the chair, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. Yeah, thank you for asking that question. ExxonMobil is extremely excited about this project. Our Alaska assets are a key part of our worldwide portfolio. And, you know, we believe, you know, this project has good fundamentals. You know, we have a proven resource base. We have good proximity relative to the market. We have a cooperative state of Alaska supporting the project. And so, you know, ExxonMobil is doing things to move this project forward. You know, I'll point out our Point Thompson investment for the initial production system that's underway right now. It's a $4 billion development to begin the initial hydrocarbon production at Point Thompson. Initially, we'll be producing condensate that will be put into the Trans-Alaska pipeline, but it is a it's pre-positioning Point Thompson for major gas sales to be able to flow into the Alaska LNG project. Of course, we're an owner at Point Thompson, very supportive of the operator there and the operations, and you know, doing the work to get Prudhoe Bay ready. And then one thing that hits close to home is throughout the years, our Alaska business for the gas project has been stewarded by what we call the ExxonMobil Production Company. And the progress that we've made on this project recently has caused our management to transfer responsibility of this project from ExxonMobil Production Company to ExxonMobil Development Company. That's our global organization that execute mega projects around the world. And so that's a noteworthy move on our part that allows the right people to be working on the project as we prepare to go into pre-FEED, as we talked about last night. And so, you know, those are some indications about how important Alaska Gas is to ExxonMobil and some evidence of recent activities that underscore that importance.
Okay, very good. If I can go to the next question.
Go ahead.
Okay, as I mentioned, Exxon has projects all around the world, but so do all the companies here, BP and ConocoPhillips and TransCanada. And I know there's been some talk about projects in Australia and how there's been a lot of cost overruns. And I don't know if these cost overruns were because of the dollar exchange or because of labor costs, because of material costs, because of shortage of pipe. I don't know why the cost overruns, but as you all mentioned, $65 billion is today's estimate, and that's a big number. How are we going to avoid cost overruns on this project?
Senator Myers, through the chair, this is Dave Antile with BP. And, well, we're certainly aware of the sort of the daunting challenge associated with this project. It's really a combination of mega projects, you know, several multi-billion-dollar projects all put together, which is in and of itself a bit unusual, which adds to the challenge. We have a multi-billion-dollar gas treatment facility to install on the North Slope, a multi-billion-dollar 800-mile pipeline to Tidewater, and then, you know, tens of billions of dollar liquefaction plant. We're aware of that. We have each of our companies has a very similar stage gate decision-making process to be very disciplined about project management and evaluate costs at every step of the way, identify risk mitigations to try to solve problems as they come up. The situation in Australia, my understanding of the situation in Australia is there's many reasons why we've experienced the cost overruns, and you've touched on most, if not all of them, a combination of the labor market, materials, logistics, and the exchange rate, all sort of conspired against. And we had a whole bunch of projects sort of looking to be maturing at a similar time. The good news in Alaska is we have really focused on one major project. The bad news is it's huge. So we will have some of that same, you know, the project creating its own weather sort of a thing. Again, the good news is we know that. We can see that coming, and there's some steps we can take along the way to ensure that we're working with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to develop training programs and ensure we have trained Alaskans available to work on the project and whatnot. So we need to work together, these companies along with the state, to face those challenges. And again, the one galvanizing fact, I think, for all the companies here is we want the project to be a success,
to compete in the world market and to be delivered at the lowest cost possible. That's going to make us relentless about identifying opportunities to reduce costs and minimize the risks of the project.
I think another thing that was interesting to me when Mr. Persily testified was that every project in the world that we're competing with has its own problems. We tend to think our problems are the only ones that are insurmountable because all you got to do is stick your head out the window when it's 50 below and figure that's an insurmountable problem there. But I was encouraged in some ways, although I'm not sure it really changes the challenge, it doesn't change the challenges that you're going to have to build this project. But the fact is all of them have challenges. Senator Meyer, do you have more further questions?
One more question, and this one may be a bit unfair, but I'll ask it anyway. This is for Mr. Fowsky. Mr. Fowsky, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I heard you say at a public forum that if SB 21 is repealed, then that has an extremely detrimental effect on this gas pipeline going forward. Is that still your belief?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, it certainly is. From a strictly business perspective, gentlemen sitting around me can certainly answer it better, but as an observer and someone that's been fairly involved now in developing a project, oil's king in this state and probably will be for quite some time. Gas is very important. And I can't imagine the producers, again, this is me, my opinion, but getting too involved in a gas pipeline if their oil tax base is in disarray or in question. They're not going to sit down, in my opinion, and build a gas pipeline until that gets resolved. And I don't make that statement from a partisan perspective. It's simply business. And so I think that it would have a detrimental effect on gas pipelines going forward until it was resolved or that there was certainty in fiscal terms going forward, because you're looking at, you know, the core of their business taking a hit versus a decision to spend $65 billion to move a project. It just is common sense to think that there's going to be quite a disruption in that process if we go back in time on tax fiscal certainty for firms.
That's a good point. And obviously, we're counting on future gas to be found. I mean, we know there's Point Thompson, we know there's Prudhoe Bay, but we also know there's a bunch more yet to be discovered up there. And if people aren't exploring for oil, then they're not going to find gas. So I guess your point is well taken, that oil is king, will be king for some time.
Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, to Mr. Fowsky, following up on two previous senators' questions. So I believe we've established for the record that we have five offtake points that are part of the project, and I understand our partner's interest, and our interests may be different when it comes to those offtake points. So specifically to Mr. Fowsky, have we identified five locations running across over 800 miles of where those offtake points might be? We were asking for specific locations, and we know that they'll be finalized later, but about where in the regions have we established those spots, or have you?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I can't address that question to the large pipe. I can to some degree for our project. One, of course, is Fairbanks. We are in discussions with the communities along, as we've done our what we've called our Rev 6, our pipeline corridor, you know, that we've made some changes to where the pipe's going to go, but in communications with Anderson and Cantwell and Nanana, Willow, Talkeetna, the various communities along the way, we're going to be working very closely with them. Our Community Advisory Council is very engaged to figure out not only where those offtake points on our line now, I'm talking about, and how we then work with those communities to get gas to the communities. I'm not trying to, I just can't address on the larger, I haven't been involved in that.
Thank you, Mr. Fowsky. So for the administration, if that is a yet to be determined item, then we want that very clear on the record about how that determination will happen. Specifically from different areas in the legislature that I serve, I'm hoping that we're working with AEA on the regional plans that should be being developed, and the best source of energy for those particular regions as we look at integrating, as Senator Hoffman and Senator Dunleavy has spoken to earlier. So we want, again, all hands on deck as far as energy, and we want, if this gas can provide that lower cost energy into those communities, we want it identified in regional plans that it can actually get to their burner tips versus a point that they have to travel to get that. So I hope we're working with AEA and the renewable energy, because we're investing a lot of money through power cost equalization and projects throughout Alaska to provide lower cost energy elsewhere. First question. Mr. Palmer, could you please tell Alaskans TransCanada's ability to finance? And if you could, I don't know if you can get into specifics about your capacity as a company to carry debt, at the percentage that you would carry that debt, and then the value of that to your shareholders first, and then second, what's the value to Alaskans for us to enter into a contract for you to carry our debt? And I know in previous conversations we've looked at the delta and the margin on that, but if you could just take a few minutes to describe that relationship and that value both to your shareholders as a company and then to the people of Alaska.
Senator Faircloth, the chair, thank you. Firstly, TransCanada would finance its involvement in this project either through its balance sheet, which would be the norm, or through non-recourse financing on a project basis. That's yet to be determined. Would be determined at the as we move closer to the final investment decision. Traditionally, we do it straight off our balance sheet. We're a very large corporation that raises capital in challenging markets as well as normal markets. Certainly, when we had the issues in the financial market just 4 or 5 years ago, TransCanada was able to raise capital for projects just like this at attractive rates during the depths of the financial crisis. So I'm very confident that we'll be in a position to do that for this project again on our balance sheet. And if we choose to do so on a non-recourse basis, project financing, we'll certainly be in a position to do that as well. It's a normal part of our business. Our corporation today, on average, has its debt ratio is something in the order of 60%, so actually lower corporately than what we're proposing for this project overall. Our equity ratio is closer to 40%, 4-0, rather than the 25 proposed for this project. We're an A-minus rated corporation, very conscious of retaining that A credit rating. Important to be able to access the market at all times over the course of our history, 60 years coming up on now. We've tried to protect that, and we'll do so as we go forward. We have a $38 billion capital program planned, excluding this project, through the course of this decade. Those projects, if they all come to fruition, will be in service prior to the bulk of the capital to be invested by us on this project, and will be yielding cash flow to our corporation. So I'm very confident that TransCanada is in a position to fund our approximately $5-6 billion, depending on the ultimate capital for this project. You've heard parties describe the current estimate is $45 billion to $65 billion in total, and the numbers for the liquefaction plant are about half that, and the numbers for the pipeline and the gas treatment plant is about half. So, as I recall, the state's evaluation assumed $45 billion, approximately $22 billion of which would be for the pipeline and the gas treatment plant. And depending on what the state and producers finally settle on for your tax rate, if you take 25%, that's $5.5 billion TransCanada's share if the state chooses not to exercise your option to purchase 40% interest. So I'm very confident that TransCanada is in a position to fund our component of that project, and we have done so before. We're confident we can do so for the remainder of our projects and this as well. You asked about the value of having TransCanada really funding the state share. You've seen a great deal of analysis by Black and Veatch as well as Analytica. I won't repeat that here. Certainly from TransCanada's standpoint, there are a number of values that we bring to the table. One of them is, of course, to allow the state to focus on where we think the greatest value comes to the state, in addition to providing a lower cost energy to the state citizens, and that is to do so at the lowest possible cost and to allow the state to collect its tax revenues as a sovereign. When you look at the analysis being completed and put in front of you, that is where the bulk of the value comes to the state. Investing in the project can also bring value. You can see that the proposed capital structure that we have in front of the legislature for your consideration for the pipeline and the gas treatment plant for our section has 75% debt and 25% equity. I will tell you that's from an investor standpoint, that's an aggressive structure. By that I mean it has more debt than most traditional pipeline projects. And in fact, I believe that Commissioner Rodell and Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski yesterday presented that to this committee. You would have seen that with a capital structure of 50% or more debt, FERC's generic policy, and it's not actually a written policy, but their generic policy in that structure is to have a 14% return on equity. If you have more than 50% debt, you'll note that TransCanada's proposal is to have 75% debt and a 12% return on equity, and you do need to look at those components on a combined basis. If you take the weighted average cost of capital that we're proposing once in service, at 75 debt, at 5% and 12% return on equity on 25, you get a weighted average cost of capital of 6.75%. I would tell you that that is an aggressive rate. That is not a high rate on a competitive basis. So TransCanada feels that we have put forward highly competitive commercial terms relative to other projects of this scale for the components that we're participating in. And we're comfortable with the risk that we are bearing relative to the reward, and we would hope that the state considers that as well. We were able to convince the administration of that, and you've seen some of their analysis. I'll stop at this point, Senator Faircloth, unless you have additional points you'd like me to address.
Senator Faircloth?
If I could move to the producers, and I may come back to TransCanada. We've heard in our offices from local communities about the terms inside of the HOA regarding the payment in lieu of taxes. And I would state and see if you concur that the reason that you're looking for, but I believe you're looking for certainty so that we as project partners can determine actually the economics of the project. So that would be the first question. And instead of me telling you what the answer is, maybe I should ask, why are you supporting inside of the HOA payment in lieu of taxes? And then the secondary question for each of you to answer is, as a state whose constitution defines local control, I'm not sure that I can go there inside of the HOA. And so I'm wondering if there's an alternate solution that the companies, our partners, would consider in establishing a process to create that local buy-in. I understand that we need the economics and the certainty and that you're looking for that in taxation, and otherwise I just don't know whether there will be the will in our bodies to not allow local property tax collection or some kind of form, whether that's a process going into. So I'm sorry it wasn't very eloquent, but I think you get the gist of it. If you could identify yourselves and tell us how we might reach a solution inside of 60 people negotiating now.
Yeah, Senator Faircloth, through the chair, my name is Pat Flood with ConocoPhillips. So just to begin with your question. The heads of agreement talks about in consultation, the administration in consultation with local governments doing two things. The first is actually impact payments to offset project impacts. And the second is this idea of payment of property taxes on a unit throughput basis, or PILT. And to address the first part of your question, one of the things we like about PILTs, and one of the things that we discussed with the administration about PILTs, goes back to this idea of alignment again. One of the great things about PILTs is the project is paying property taxes in relationship to its actual throughput and thus its actual revenues. And so the project participants then once again are now in alignment with the municipalities and the local government. So its core idea is really one of alignment, is which you see permeating the entire heads of agreement. So the heads of agreement, as we've talked about, is a roadmap or a plan. And so in this case, the roadmap or plan is there'd be consultation by the administration with local governments about these payments, both the impact payments and the PILTs. And so we haven't really discussed specifics about that. And so to getting to your, is there an alternate solution? I think what there is there's a plan. And the plan is laid out in the heads of agreement, but as we've talked about, if that somehow doesn't work for people, then we'll continue our problem solving. And I think from ConocoPhillips' perspective, it's that simple. We think this is something we like. We've reached agreement on it, but if it doesn't work, we'll keep talking.
If I might,
Senator Fairclough.
I appreciate that, Mr. Flood. Some of the concern is that how a local community might value the asset is very different than how the producers, at least in the past, with our history in TAPS, might value that. And so when we have the courts intervening on the municipalities or the local interest behalf and then siding with those communities, I don't want to say it's mistrust. I think that there's a different way that we're perceiving the value. So from the owner's perspective, if I've owned an asset for 30 years and have been depreciating the asset, it might be of one value on my balance sheets. But to the local community that asset is sitting in, it is a great value because it's carrying the lifeblood of Alaska, per se, in billions of dollars worth of assets. So I don't say one is wrong or right. I say that we have different interests in that value. And the courts have decided on that value that sometimes, most of the time, that the municipality that's carrying that lawsuit has appropriately made their case, and in the eyes of the courts, that value is increased. And so that's the rub between the PILT and the process that the administration might go forward with our other partners in trying to establish that process for determination. And so that's what I'm trying to get. How do we, as partners, putting on a different hat for the state, but partners in a process that is seeking to align our interests, but understanding our Constitution has that local control, how do we meet those individual needs?
Dan, you want to go ahead and address that?
If I may, I'd like to make one comment through the chair to Senator Fairclough. On the ASAP project, and you folks know me the way you do in my former life with the North Slope Borough, where I was the tax guy and have negotiated PILT payments in the past. I did them with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation as well. We built the property taxes into our tariff model on the ASAP project. That's not to say I'm opposed to PILTs, but I know in our discussions with this, PILTs can be very worthwhile. PILTs can be very negotiated well. But I agree with you, Senator, and this was an issue that I've raised, and it's just one that's probably down the road a little bit, but I can certainly understand the concerns of municipal leaders because this is their life's blood. So I think Mr. Flood said it well. This is an issue that needs to be addressed very well with local governments to make sure that there's no mystery involved with it.
Senator Fairclough, before you ask your next question, I just want the record to reflect that Senator Bishop has joined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I still would like to hear from the other producers, but I want to add that consultation is not very comforting as a sovereign, and I say that reflective of the federal government. I serve nationally on the labor and economic development, and so I've had some interesting conversations with the U.S. trade officers, and they want to consult with us when they pass these trade agreements, where sometimes we've seen that they totally circumvent and have international corporations bypass local state procurement codes. And so consulting, you know, doesn't provide me comfort. Just that word, doesn't it? You know, that just is a checkbox. I called you up, you were consulted, and now I have not a meaningful dialogue with how this affects my community. So I just say consulting, you know, I have a little issue with.
Go ahead, Mr. Vantile.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, Dave Vantile with BP. In response to your question, I agree with what both my colleagues to the left here have said, and I guess I'd like to supplement just a bit. Why PILTs are important? One is that investors don't like uncertainty. So to the extent we can define things that makes our decisions, especially when you're facing a $45 to $65 billion project, easier. And so that's largely what we're trying to create through the heads of agreement and through the forward process that we've identified to try to define as much certainty as we can. We think that that actually benefits all parties, that certainty, the investors, and hopefully the local communities as well. We have outlined in Article 9.3.1 of the HOA this process that you're referring to of the property tax PILTs that we're proposing and working those with the local communities. For it to be successful, this is a theme that, you know, pick the issue, and I think this is going to be true. For it to be successful, it's going to have to work for all the parties. Yes, we'll have a consultation. It needs to be more than just a tick-the-box exercise. It has to be meaningful, and we know that. At the end of the day, the process that's outlined in the HOA and in SB 138 calls for a negotiation to occur, and then the fruits of that negotiation to be brought back to this body. And if that hasn't been robustly worked with the local governments, then I can't imagine this body will be particularly pleased, and, you know, we'll see the outcome. We will obviously want the resulting agreements to be ratified because we want to get after prosecuting the project and letting it compete in the world markets. We know that property tax payments, as you characterize, Senator Fairclough, are the lifeblood of the local communities. They're critically important. And so, yes, we want to find a solution that works for everybody. If there's legal issues and whatnot, we need to roll up our sleeves and solve them.
Senator Bishop? Senator Fairclough, you saw him.
Mr. Chairman, I can certainly wait and follow up. I wanted to hear from ExxonMobil also.
Go ahead, Bill.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. Given the value of property tax on a project like this, we fully expect to address property tax in the project enabling agreements. And so, what I will add to the conversation is that if we're able to agree on what impact payments need to be paid during construction, if we're able to agree on a formulation for satisfying property tax that's predictable and durable, and that the state of the administration supports as well as the community's support, we'd expect that to show up in a contract that we come back to this body for ratification. And to be approved by this body, we would expect it would have to have robust community support. And we can't come up with these solutions without consultation. And we really look forward to working with the administration on making that meaningful consultation because we're all in this together. solutions that only meet the needs of certain parties and not others are not solutions at all. So, thank you.
Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, a statement, then I can yield. I have other questions if others are in the...
That's what we're here for.
First, I appreciate your willingness to act in good faith as a partner, and certainly the state is attempting to do that, but our partners are split into 60 different pockets, and so I hope you understand that as a partner with equal footing, we want to make sure that we're protecting the entities of the places and people that we represent. I'll yield and let Senator Bishop ask.
Whatever your preference is,
and then I can come back to. I just have a couple other questions.
Okay, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along this tax discussion, then I want to come back and ask one question to Tony Palmer.
Right.
I concur with the discussion and the questioning from Senator Fairclough, and I myself, you know, my mayor, he's got me on speed dial. And as we're having this discussion, and it's, you know, we talk about alignment. I'm going to call it tentative alignment. We talk about this tentative alignment, and it's not only the people sitting here at the table, but we can all appreciate now and see that this alignment goes all the way down right to the local level and the individual citizen in the state to make this project work. I think that's starting to really come out now, and people see that. And Dave, I was really, you know, I can appreciate fiscal certainty from the industry's perspective. I get it. But also, you can appreciate a local mayor's can play the same card and say the local government wants fiscal certainty, you know? So we're connected as this thing goes forward. So. You can appreciate my local government's concern on this project. And I'm not saying, you know, after we learn more about the project, because right now we're not even in the game, right? We got to do something here to get the pre-feed to get on the bench. So as more numbers come available, as we all work together, maybe this PILT will be the right way to go, spread the payments over time, and people further understand the economics of the project. So, and then coming back to value, and Mr. Chairman, if I might, with Tony Palmer, because my background is in construction, cost overruns freaked me out. And if you could provide, with the chairman's permission, if you could provide me, and I don't know if the rest of the committee's interested in this, but could you provide us with, could you go back 10 years in TransCanada's history of pipeline construction and show us the projects that you've completed in the last 10 years, and were they on budget, under budget, or over budget? Thank you.
Mr. Palmer?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, yes, I can undertake to do that. I don't have that at my fingertips, but I know that we have an excellent record in delivering projects on schedule and on budget. I can undertake to provide that to you and the committee.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, gentlemen, as we look at what's gone on over the history of LNG, and I wasn't here at the very beginning, but I have been here for the last however many years it has been, since 2001, and we saw AGEA come and go, and we saw why it was shot down. Apparently the shale gas was the thing that really put the knife into the back there. What are the backup plans if for some reason a shale gas equivalent with advancing technology and advancing process comes on? What's the backup plan to make sure that the investment that the state puts in, as well as the private sector puts in, is protected, and that we don't lose our shirts in the long run? And the reason I bring that up right now is because we are definitely in deficit spending, and the state of Alaska at this point is in a ill position to go ahead and undertake something that's quite risky.
Senator Olson,
is there a backup plan?
Senator Olson, if I understand your question, you're saying if there is some market force or natural force or something unforeseen that essentially makes this project uneconomic.
Yes,
okay, what's the backup? What's plan B, I guess, is the question.
Senator Olson through the chair. So to begin with, we're at the beginning of a multi-stage stage gate process. And so the first thing is that the stage gates is where the decisions are made, and that's the first step in that risk management, if you will. Mm-hmm. As you've also heard from your consultant, Analytica, LNG projects are almost always backed by some form of firm sales and purchase agreement with buyers in Asia, by which they tend to share some of that risk. The other thing that you heard from your consultant Analytica is that LNG projects, the risk tends to be in the level of return that they provide, not in terms of an absolute cash loss. Having said that, all of those things, this is a project with a market, with a sales price, with a cost or an investment, and there is no guarantee. So there are ways that we manage risk, we recognize risk, but ultimately there is no guarantee.
Mr. Chairman, so the summary is that we don't have a backup plan for the...
Well,
it's part of business. Risk.
Well, I guess what my takeaway from that was is that we're going to go into this in stages, and at every stage we're either going to have we're going to have the possibility of contracts or not, and ultimately before the trigger is pulled and the huge investment is made, we're going to have contracts in place, and so the plan B is that you never really get into a situation where you need a plan B because you have future contracts.
Continue, Mr. Chairman. Unless Senator Olson wants to comment.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I don't pretend to have LNG for sale, but I am a student of the game, and perhaps I could just comment and add to what Mr. Flood described. Absolutely, the structure that he described, where you have long-term sales contracts where the buyer is taking on a significant other volume or price risk, is a plan B. That's absolutely the case. And in addition, because you're putting the gas on the water, you actually have alternative markets, which you don't traditionally have in a pipeline. You generally go into a single location in a pipeline. In this case, once you get to Nikiski, you put it on a ship. Ideally, at the moment, you would be shipping to Asia. If that market were to change, and you have certainly seen that occur in other markets over the last short while, in fact, lots of LNG was targeted to go to North American markets right now. It's being diverted to alternative markets. So there is a plan B, I would suggest, by these folks, as well as C and D. But yes, ultimately, if the gas price were a dollar around the world, you would have a problem on this project, as you would on every other project.
Mr. Fosky? If I may, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Olson, AGDC, in reference, is kind of a backup plan if a larger project were not to go. It's kind of the importance, I think, of the governor himself and others have referred to it as the ace in the hole. Hopefully that decision is sooner rather than later as we move down towards sanctioning and other things, but it doesn't represent a backup plan in terms of the amount of revenue it could possibly generate for the state's treasury, but it is back to that security concern and getting gas to Alaskans. So I think there's some comfort level there that we've got a project that's moving forward very well that can serve in some capacity. If I may, Senator, we're looking at plus or minus 30% right now on our numbers as we move towards sanctioning. If we were to get, if this continued online 2016, ideally you're at plus or minus 10% when you get to that point. And you try, as many of you learn in mega projects, the classes that were, people were brought up here to brief legislators, that old statement that speed kills on these projects. And that is, you get a schedule, you want to stick to it, but you try not to alter it too much to always jump in schedules around, because the importance goes into the preliminary planning and those long-term sales agreements. But your question's a good one, and I think that's about the best answer I can help offer is these folks will do a tremendous job on their end, but you do have some security in a corporation that you own that is also working on a project.
Let me take just a real quick and easy here for a moment. So I'm trying to remember the order of folks who were speaking. Senator Olson, did you have further questions?
I did, but I understand there's a follow-up question on the table.
Okay, Senator Dunleavy,
follow-up.
Go ahead.
Brief. There's a however for Mr. Fauske. If these folks don't think it's economical, how could it be economical for us with a smaller line? In other words, if it's not economical for them, it's gonna. We can still build a line. We've done these things in Alaska for years. Still build something, but in the end, that gas is going to cost more if it's not economical for them.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, you raise a good point. However, our motivation is somewhat different, right. And that is theirs is strictly based on, as it should be, on a commercial activity business. What is in the best interest of their shareholders? What makes sense to their global strategy? Ours, as I've stated many times, are we able to beat the price of imported LNG? And if we can't do that, then this becomes a fool's errand. If we can, at the limitation that we're currently under, at 500 million feet of gas, still come up, and Alaska, on a good day, or a cold day, I guess you will, uses about 240, 250 million feet of gas a day. At our limitation at 250 million feet, when we held an expression of interest, which was a non-binding but confidential statement of interest by firms and individuals, we exceeded the 500 million feet in reference to desire to possibly use gas. So that gave us some window of opportunity then for a limited commercial activity, not on as grand a scale as this, but to help keep those costs down and lower those tariffs for Alaskan citizens with a commercial application going forward. So as we monitor and keep structuring this project, it's important to bear in mind that we want it to be economical, where our mandate is to bring gas to Alaska at the lowest possible cost. And so far, we're continuing to do that. We hope this other works out, but I think our imperative is slightly different. Doesn't mean we go off and do something silly, but right now it's looking pretty good in reference to the ability to beat an imported commodity coming into our state versus develop one ourselves.
I think your opening sentence kind of answered the question, which is we have different motivations. They're vastly different projects. Senator Fairclough?
Just on that point, I just would like, for those at home who are listening, that's not the only reason someone could take an off-ramp in this particular proposal. It's not an off-ramp just based on economics. The partners could have a different reason for not wanting to participate in the project anymore. We could change something inside of SB 138 that it doesn't provide them the same internal rate of return that they want. We could do something, something could happen environmentally or otherwise around the world that could cause a partner to not be willing to participate. And we've heard the partners say today that they obviously would look at that one partner if they were changed in their willingness to participate in the process, that we would look and try to mitigate those things. But I just wanted to, that it could be another reason beside uneconomical that we might switch to Plan B is my only point, Mr. Chairman.
Good point.
Senator Olson.
I continue, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fauske, as you looked at statewide as the financial guru of whatever's out there, and because over the last several years we've seen many of the mega projects that have gone under, that have needed somebody to take the helm, and they've always been referred to you when you were the HFC and other that goes on down the line, whether it's the bullet line or AGDC or whatever else. But what was pointed out to me was that one of the things that was completed back in 2011 was the Goose Creek Correctional Center for $250 million, which, as was pointed out to me, and I realize it's not your fault, but went tens of millions of dollars over budget. And with that in mind, I guess the idea that your focus may be scattered since you have so many things that you're out there dealing with, how do you plan on drilling down to this multi-billion dollar, multi-party pipeline to make sure that it pencils or continues to work for the best of the citizens of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I appreciate your comments. Last year I was asked to focus entirely on this project, so for 3 years I was doing both this and Alaska Housing. So it's helped to get over and excuse me, being focused primarily on this project. We have very clear stated goals that we want to do. We have a very, very clear mission that we're trying to do. And I've been fortunate in being able to hire and bring on people, most of whom are Alaskan, to help us stay on that very path that your concerns, and they're good concerns. I can assure you that we're razor sharp on our focus on this project. There's a lot of moving parts, but I think we've got a good handle on it. And in reference to those things that need to be addressed, those things you keep an eye on. I think the other thing that helps us is involvement with the legislature and administration, because we have the ability to come back in. Questions get raised on a pretty timely manner. But I assure you that we are focused on this project, and I will give it my very best effort.
My last question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
My idea, and you've brought it out, and this validates you as far as I'm concerned. Ever since I've been here in the legislature and realized you were up and barrel during the best of times and during the worst of times, well, I'm not sure the worst of times, but you have spent your time out in, well, even if there was a hub community, you were out there, and so you've got a perspective that is credible. And with that, I see that unless we have a definitive plan to bring gas to the burner tip of people in rural Alaska, it doesn't matter whether you bring it 800 miles, as you pointed out, to 100 miles. You say that's good, but unless you bring it to the burner tip with a definitive plan, I don't think that person out there in rural Alaska is going to go ahead and benefit from it, partly because, as we see the out-migration from the rural areas, because they can't afford to heat their homes, and less people are out there with less and less representation. We've seen that over the last census, it's going to be something that's going to be expensive, and that as soon as the state starts to get into a financial situation, they're not going to continue on. My question to you is, can you come up with a plan that we could have to bring it to the burner tip that's more definitive than dependent on transportation routes for a possible amendment to Senate Bill 138?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that might be a little difficult, but what I can tell you is that the cost of doing nothing exceeds the cost of a project. By that I mean the costs in rural are only going to continue to go up, and the opportunities that we have to develop resources are going to become, they'll still be there, but they're more limited than the cost, the cost of things going up. I hope that makes sense. As I stated earlier, I think maybe in reference to Senator Hoffman, until we get a pipe, until we get a source of energy, these things become so much easier to do. One of our biggest costs here is transportation and distances. And I mentioned Donlin Creek. That's a huge project. They're looking at a $1 billion expenditure on their own. If we can tie into something like that, the opportunity to get to the Lower Yukon and into the Bethel area and regions around there becomes so much more viable than it currently sits, because you now have a resource that you can factor in what the costs are doing it from that point versus Prudhoe Bay. So it is a stated part of our mission statement to be exploring ideas, and that includes Southeast. There's all kinds of ideas that have been put on the table. So I can't, sir, come at you with a definitive plan at this point, but I can tell you that it's certainly part of our mission. I'm going to give some more thought to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson, one of the things I would call attention to is the presentation we had about 3 weeks ago. It was actually from the Association of Village Presidents regarding the pipeline across, or the road across, from the Paiute Slough to the Kuskokwim. All that's well and good, unless the product that you're delivering, which we envision diesel, it's fine, except if the price of the diesel isn't lowered, it really doesn't make sense to do any of this. And we can't hope to get diesel lowered at our refineries until we get LNG or some form of energy where they can produce that stuff cheaper. And so I think anything that you produce in the pipe that is envisioned by AGDC will help us throughout the state in our effort to begin to produce
energy cheaper, even if it is still diesel, and you don't get something at the burner tip. And the other thing, too, to keep in mind on the larger project, as far as its benefit to rural and all of Alaska, is tab 3, page 3, the anticipated revenues that we see from this. I mean, my goodness, that looks like the answer, and it comes at a really interesting time, which is like 2022, 2024, like that, not 2024, which is also the period of time that we see revenues crashing in the state. So this, I think that if we look, have a narrow view of getting LNG or gas to a burner tip, that's certainly a benefit, and that's something we want to work towards, but there are many benefits to the state, ancillary benefits that come just from doing this project, and even some of them result in cheaper energy that maybe isn't gas. Senator Fairclough, if you had another question?
Mr. Chairman, I have about four more questions, but...
You know what? Senator Hoffman, do you have one question? Senator Hoffman raised his hand. If you have four...
Problem, you know, I had three different areas, but I don't know what the time frame is.
Okay.
To have, so.
Go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
I'm not sure the time frame of Mr. Palmer. I know that we had till 12:30, so I just was going to focus my questions first to him in case he needed to leave. Mr. Palmer?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, thank you. My flight is at 1:55, so I have I can certainly stay till 12 or 12:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we have session 11, so.
To everyone, on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, we created a fund for dismantlement and restoration. And those have been carried specifically on the producer's books, as I understand it. So I want that clarification if that fund is actually housed on your balance sheets for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. But to Mr. Palmer, with 40,000, is it miles of pipe in North America, I'm wondering what your company typically does for dismantlement and restoration and how those, if there's a fund that's created, where that fund is housed so that the people of Alaska would know, should a project be successful, looking out into my children and their grandchildren's future, what that looks like for Alaskans as far as dismantlement and restoration if the project were successful. So I'm looking way down the road.
Can I just interject one thing? Senator Fairclough, because that is an issue that is not envisioned in this piece of legislation before us, can we maybe go to another question just in interest of time so that we can get to Senator Hoffman's questions as well?
I can yield to Senator Hoffman, Mr. Chairman, but it should be included in this conversation.
Well, it's not, I mean, the reclamation is certainly not a piece of the MOA. Maybe it is. I think maybe in some broad terms, is it? Just yes or no?
Mr. Chairman, Pat Flood with ConocoPhillips, it's not specifically addressed. Okay. It would be addressed in project agreements.
That's fine. Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, I have three areas. Again, gas to Alaskans, Alaskan jobs, and state investment. And to follow up on several senators' statements here, gas to Alaskans is a very, very high priority. When we're considering investing 20% at the low end for $45 billion, that's $9 billion for the state of Alaska. At the high end, $65 billion, 25%, that's $17 billion. So we're talking $9 to $17 billion on the state of Alaska's investment. And I appreciate Mr. Fauske's pointing out on page 10 of the HOA that item E, which basically says that create the opportunity for delivery. For the amount of money the state of Alaska is considering, it seems as though we need to have a little bit more assurances, and I know it's early on in the stage, a little bit more assurances for the amount of money for Alaskans, just creating the opportunity. So I know the agreement has been signed, but we have the legislation in front of us now, and I think that I agree with Senator Dunleavy and Senator Olson that in the in Senate Bill 138, we need more specific, more stronger, much more stronger language, so that Alaskans can feel that if we are going to be investing these vast sums, that at the end of the project, there is more than an opportunity for delivery to all Alaskans. So that is basically a statement. Alaskan jobs, I wanted to say that, you know, I've been here for a while, and the record on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline isn't glowing, and somehow that needs to be improved, and I don't want to ask them to make a presentation on that here today, but I would like to them to contemplate answering that, how Alaskans can feel better when this line is constructed than they were treated during the construction of the Alaska Pipeline. But the one that I would like them to answer today is the state's investment, my third question. And that is, we are contemplating in this proposal, which we can change the percentages at this table, but in here we have the amounts from 20 to 25%. My question is, how would this project fare if this committee decided not to participate and follow the same avenue that we did when we were constructing the Alaska Pipeline? I wonder if each of the three producers can address that. How would this project fare in their view?
So, Senator Hoffman, you said you had three questions?
No, just the one.
Just the one, okay, all right. Go ahead, and on the percentages. And could you restate that question?
I asked for them to answer in writing on the Alaskan jobs. How would it,
okay,
Alaskans would fare,
okay,
because I don't believe that they would say that they fared very well in the construction of the Alaskan Pipeline. How would they see putting in writing to make that better for Alaskans? But my question is, we're... This legislation asks for 20 to 25% investments for Alaska. If we change this legislation and did not participate at all, how would each one of the majors view the possibilities of the pipeline?
Go ahead, General.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, Dave Vantile with BP. One of the critical bedrock elements in BP's perspective of the heads of agreement is the idea of aligned interest across the value chain for all the parties. In general, we think in BP's involvement in mega LNG projects around the world, that's what we try to do. We try to align the interest that we have in the upstream resource with the equity that we own in the project. And generally, our co-venturers often do the same thing. It's a great way to mitigate risk and create alignment. Having the host government do the same thing creates that unprecedented alignment that we're talking about. The host government owns it's the gas resource, its royalty share under the HOA. We talk about the state's ability to take the producers to be able to pay our production tax obligation as gas. That creates this 20 to 25% ownership. Taking a corresponding equity in the project, then the state has the resource ownership aligned with equity all the way across. The huge advantage that creates for the efficient prosecution of the project is, as issues arise in the future, and they will, we'll now see those solutions in a similar way because we're situated similarly. We own a resource, we own equity in the project, and it's likely then that we're able to find mutually agreeable solutions. Not having that sort of alignment then creates the possibility that we'll be on opposite sides of the table on every issue along the way. That creates inherent risk in the project. We've seen that in the past when we get to things like valuation of the resource. Even if we have a, hearkening back to some data that has been shared by Analytica, what the total cumulative revenues to the project might be for the state might be in the neighborhood of $100 billion. That's a nice round number. It's easy to work with. If we had a dispute
that was a 1% dispute on valuation. That's a pretty small 1% is, you know, 99% agreement, right? But even a 1% difference is a billion-dollar or more value dispute, which is tremendous. If we're able to have alignment across the value chain in the manner that's described in the HOA, many of those issues disappear, and it really helps with the likelihood that we're able to find mutually agreeable commercial solutions. So the state investment in the project, consistent with that percentage, is vitally important, we think, to the commercial alignment made possible in the project. Maybe my colleagues would like to add.
Senator Hoffman, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil through the chair. I guess one thing I can point to is the reports from the State of Alaska consultants. Black and Veatch have reported the advantages of state participation in the project, as well as PFC Energy and Analytica. And so with state participation, taking royalty in kind and taking gas, taking taxes gas, would then underpin that that participation and create that alignment that Mr. Van Tuyl has talked about.
Senator Hoffman, you bring up an excellent point, too, and I think it goes to the larger questions that we as a legislature have to answer before we have a project of this size. When you talk about our ability to hire Alaskans, there's this crazy connection between the discussion here today and the common omnibus crime bill. In rural Alaska, there's probably a disproportionate number of people with felonies. They won't be able to work on a project like this, and yet we have a bill before us that maybe straightens those kinds of things out. Our STEM scores are too low. We need more engineers, and we need process techs and geotechs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've got to have a workforce, and we're going to have to make some decisions in the budget and in our statutes to make sure our education program is better, our university is stronger, our training programs are better, on and on and on. I don't think we're ready as a state for a project this big, and we have, besides this SB 138, which in some respects is a fairly minor piece of legislation in the overall, in the context of the larger project, you've got your job to do, and we've got our job to do that has nothing to do with what's in SB 38 or the coming SB 138 that we'll see next year or the enabling legislation and on and on and on. We've got to get ready. And we don't appear real ready right now. We've got to get our fiscal house in order too, so we can play in this game. Money's going to be an issue. Bells are ringing. Senator Hoffman, you have one more question from Senator Frankloff.
To Jim Flood, Pat Flood. I'd like to say that I really like your tie.
So, Senator Frankloff, if there's fashion comments, we're...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard the bells. There are still important questions to be asked about the dismantlement and restoration fund. I asked Mr. Palmer. He has international expertise on what pipelines do. I'd like to hear the answer to that, but if now is not the time, I'd like it in writing. You can make that call.
We can make sure that Mr. Pulaski and Mr. Balash can certainly bring that up in further talks.
The next question goes to the producer specifically. As a sovereign involved as a partner in this project, there's a federal tax benefit that is being made by the entire project as a whole, alignment, some might say. But there's a specific dollar amount, and I don't know if it's proprietary, whether you can share that or not, about what that value is to your federal tax payment. What's the benefit of having a sovereign to the producers based on part of the project being non-taxable? And if you, or is it not an issue?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, I don't believe myself or any of my other compatriots here are tax experts, but we don't understand that there would be any tax benefit to the producers.
It would not reduce your federal income tax by having 20% to 25% of the value of the project off the table in a government entity?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. The way we're envisioning the project being structured, all those benefits would flow to the state of Alaska and its agents in the project. And ExxonMobil would pay its federal income tax based on its income off the project. You know, each one would handle their share of the project. And so we did not envision any dilution of those benefits among the parties, that they would be, you know, belong to the state of Alaska.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. If I might, I'm not sure who can talk about it. I certainly can't very well, but I know that a while ago we had a federal loan guarantee at the federal government level. Can anyone tell me whether that expired or whether that is still available as far as help for, helping support this project?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, Dave Antile with BP. I mean, certainly, start with a broad statement. Financing for the project's going to be important, and attracting that in the most efficient, least expensive way is, I think, to the benefit of all. I'm aware, under the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004, that there was certain provisions made available, loan guarantees for that project envisioned at the time, which was a pipeline of the Lower 48. I'm not aware that that sort of a provision would be available for this project, however. And I don't know if any of my colleagues have supplemental information. Clearly, financing is important. It's going to be hugely on the radar screen of anything this size. But I'm not sure that that's available for this project.
Mr. Fasky?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I remember that issue very well under Senator Stevens, and I thought it was about $15 billion, or it was a big number.
It was a big number.
I'm going to do a little research on that and try and find out if that has sunset, if it still exists.
Thank you. That's specifically what I didn't know, if there was a sunset or parameters inside the existing federal legislation that would have limited it, because we're still trying to get North Slope gas to market, per se. But if it was the hard line, I know we were trying to prevent an over-the-top, because we wanted, at least as I recall, the political discussion that was happening, Senator Stevens wanted to make sure Alaskans received the benefit of gas being exported or removed from Alaska, and so we wanted jobs as well as that. So it had something to do with the conversation on the over-the-top. The last question then that I have is, last night I asked, in reflection of the schedule that has been presented to this committee for advancing an Alaska LNG project, at what point would we be applying for the export permit license from our own federal government? And then when do we anticipate, inside that time schedule, either an approval or a denial of that proposal? I'm trying to get to what everyone's been concerned about. That's money investment in the plan and someone else outside of the partners being able to slow us down.
Okay, Senator Fairclough, through the chair, Bill McMahon with ExxonMobil. Yes, getting a Department of Energy export license is very important for this project. The project is currently working on the components of that application, and would expect to be able to file that with the DOE later this year. It's a very important approval for this project, and so we expect to be able to achieve that. But we'll work very close with the DOE as that project, application works its way through. Certainly, it would need to be in hand to be able to make our final investment decision. It would need to be in hand so that our LNG buyers would have confidence that they could sign long-term contracts that are going to be necessary for us to make that financial investment decision. So. You know, we have it on our radar screen. It's part of our plan, and we want to make sure that we clear that hurdle.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Typically, they last 18 months for processing on the permit application. I know that we have multiple LNG projects in looking for export in the U.S. right now that Department of – I thought Mr. Persley had told us there were multiple projects in line for evaluation. And so can you give me a time frame for once the permit is provided to the Department of Energy? Typically, how long does that approval or disapproval take?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, Pat Flynn with ConocoPhillips. I might point out that ConocoPhillips has an export application in the works as we speak. And That one we expect to happen in a relatively expedited fashion. Some of the lower 48 projects have taken quite some time, but there were some studies that needed to be done and things like that. This project will be a very different proposition in front of the Department of Energy, but we think it generally probably is, those are favorable. So we really don't know. I don't think it's that easy to tell how long something like that's going to happen, but we're very confident. We have a lot of experience at this table in regards to that, and if you are prepared and if you've done your homework, that we will secure an export license and that we will secure it in plenty of time. So,
Dan, maybe this can jog your memory a little bit, but was the loan guarantee program only for the pipeline to the lower 48?
Mr. Chairman, that's what I'm going to I'll find out not only amount, but what were the restrictions on it. I know that it was tied to that, but I don't know if it was allowed to move outside those bumpers, if you want. I'll get an answer to this.
I wonder if the likelihood of expanding it to an export project, which is not necessarily in the United States interest, might be difficult. Okay.
If I recall, sir, I believe there were some restrictions on it, but I'm going to get some information on this.
Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, if that's the case and we find out that there's limitations inside the federal guarantee, I would ask the co-chairs of finance along with the president of the Senate to direct a letter to our federal delegation asking for the expansion, because there is an American interest in providing us this particular revenue stream specifically to the Asian markets. The U.S. is some $17 trillion shy of a balanced budget, and should we increase exports to a country where they hold quite a few dollars, we could actually help decrease the national debt.
I wonder if you could make that case with anywhere, too. Huh. You know, we're about out of time. So unless there's any other quick questions that the committee has, sure appreciate you people coming and talking with us. I know you've got some schedules that you're going to have to catch flights and those kinds of things, and so we're going to lose you for a while, but I hope to see you again before this process is done. We're going to adjourn this meeting. This is actually a continuation of last night's meeting, and then we will re-adjourn at what time? Where's my thing? Keep looking at you because you need.
We should gavel in for 9 o'clock and then do it to the call of the chair if you want flexibility for schedule.
Yeah.
We get one minute.
We don't have one. Okay. So we're going to, my mistake, we're going to have to just adjourn this meeting and then take up tomorrow with Mr. Fish and. Or Mr. Plusky and Commissioner Bailey, Mr. Fish. For those of you who don't know him, that's what they call him, is Fish. So we are adjourned, and thank you all.